Good evening and welcome to the next installment of 20th Century Moments That Mattered. I want to thank the generous sponsors of the entire series, Debbie and Simcha Firestone. Very grateful for their generosity. Sorry if we don't have enough handouts. We're happy to make you more later. Or please God, the class and all the handouts and PowerPoint will be online later tonight. This is a fascinating subject. I find it fascinating because it's something that I have memories of. Usually when you talk about teaching Jewish history, you're talking about something that happened a long time ago. And even though I fancy myself as being young, though I may not appear it anymore, I do have memories of my parents taking us on Sunday into Manhattan from where we grew up in Teaneck, New Jersey, to attend Free Soviet Jewry rallies. And to me, that's a big part of this story that we're going to see tonight, is the indelible impression it had on several generations or intergenerationally. Americans who felt that they were part of a movement, something bigger than themselves, having an impact that not only was measurable, but an impact that was successful, an impact that made an enormous difference. Being part of the Soviet Jewry movement, for generations who participated in that movement helped shape their very identity as Jews. It was incredibly impactful, and that is our subject for tonight. So we're going to go through this PowerPoint. And what I'd like to do, the Soviet Jewry movement question could be a 5-year advanced university course. This is not something that in 1 hour or a little bit more that we can cover comprehensively. And that could be said probably about all the topics in the 20th Century Moments That Mattered series. So what I'd like to do is talk about a historical overview of the period, remind you, because I'm sure many of you have active memories of the unfolding of this period, and then get into a specific question, which we will in the end, the rabbinic debate about the efficacy and appropriateness of the demonstrations. What was the proper method? And it's interesting to be able to have this debate retroactively or in reflecting, because even today historians debate what was the catalyst that brought about the fall and the opening that allowed Jews to emigrate over 2 million from behind the Iron Curtain. Was it the demonstrations? Was it the quiet diplomacy? Each side that advocated for that approach, of course, also took the credit after the fact that their approach was the one that made the difference. But we'll see, and that's the part I want to study a little more in depth, is what exactly were they debating? What was the question? And I want to begin by setting the mood a little bit. Many of you may remember this song. It's sort of captured a little bit. I'm going to play a couple minutes of it just to set the mood to bring us back. By a show of hands, how many people went to Free Soviet Jewry movement rallies? So literally almost everyone in the room. Clearly, this is something which is part of your active memory, and so will this song be as well.
They call me Anatole, in prison I do lie. My little window looks out on a Russian sky. I've been arrested here for crimes they have not named, but all my people know the charge will be a frame. See my accuser standing in the hall. He points his finger at us all. You now must pay the penalty for the crime of daring to be free. We are leaving Mother Russia. We have waited far too long. We are leaving Mother Russia. When they come for us, we'll be gone. For 15 centuries we've called this land our home. We love the Russians.
Okay, I don't want to take up all of our time. by watching. It's a 6-minute video, but how many of you remember that song? You remember Safam? Whatever happened to Safam? I think they only existed for the Soviet Jewry movement. Didn't they have another song, Let Him Out? Was that them also? So that music, and again, I was a young child, but even I, when I hear that tune, that melody, that music, let alone this great video, it really takes you back to that period. And I thought that could set the tone for our conversation. In the 1920s, the rise of communism in the USSR, the new Soviet regime sought to eliminate Jewish religious identity, which is fascinating because the Jews made up a tiny fraction of the population. And even as I reviewed and studied this subject in preparation for tonight, I was taken again by what I think is such a compelling question of all of history, which is, why are Jews always at the forefront? We're a tiny number. We're an insignificant percentage. In the Cold War between America and the USSR, there were such bigger things. How is it that the presidents of the United States, how is it that this was the tension revolved around the Jews? And part of it is that the Russians, the USSR, communists, placed their focus and their attention. They wanted to eliminate Jewish religious identity, and they did that, as our enemies have time and immemorial, by depriving us of religious opportunity, access to religious experience, religious observance, religious education, and so on. Stalin, in fact, even made a push at one point to move Jews into their own province in Siberia, to isolate the Jews. Another form of putting Jews in a ghetto, not a ghetto within a city, but to create an entire city, an entire province, to be able to get rid of the Jewish problem, to isolate the Jews. 1941, we know the Nazis push into the Soviet Union, and they massacre Jews in their newly conquered territory. Among the famous examples, Babi Yar, where 52,000 Jews, men, women, and children, systematically and methodically put to death in Kiev following the Nazi occupation of the Ukrainian capital. Stalin picture on the top and a picture from Babi Yar below. By the end of the war, by the end of World War II, in the USSR, in Russia, we're not talking about in Eastern Europe, in Russia, I don't know if there's a law yet that would prevent you from saying that this happened in Russia, 532 synagogues were destroyed by the Germans in Russia. So aside from suffering under communism, we know the German impact within Russia and the suffering under the Nazis themselves. After World War II, Stalin became paranoid that the Jewish population were a fifth column and they needed to be stopped. And that should be reminiscent of the Parshios we're reading right now. It's exactly the language that when Paro, who doesn't remember Yosef, whether he didn't literally know him or chose to forget about him, the Jews had failed to lobby and to make their presence known and to remind their host country of their ancestors' transformational impact on them. So Paro gets paranoid. And Paro says they're growing in number, they're growing in power, they're growing in influence. Maybe they have a plan to overthrow me. And that's what incites, and that's what is the motivator for Paro's persecution and the 210 years of servitude. And when it comes to the Jew, history repeats itself over and over again. And as I referenced a moment ago, as we're seeing even now with Poland, I heard Alan Dershowitz speak this morning at a JNFN event. I didn't read it, but he referenced his own op-ed in the Wall Street Journal today. And I don't know whether he wrote it in there or just said it today, but this is the first example of a country practicing Holocaust denial. It's a country. They're not denying the Holocaust, but denying their role in it. It's not an individual. It's a country as an entity legislating Holocaust denial. Our enemies regurgitate the same things over and over, and Stalin regurgitated Paro's paranoia. And it manifests itself in attempts to marginalize Jews in Soviet society, always depicting them as enemies, isolating them, and degrading them. And this came out in 1952 very poignantly in the episode of The Doctor's Plot. The Doctor's Plot, I don't want to ask if anyone remembers, because I can't imagine you're going to, given the year, people are going to stop putting up their hands soon. Under Stalin, 1952-1953, a group of prominent Jewish doctors in Moscow were accused of conspiring to assassinate Soviet leaders. Right, another common theme of the fake news Jews have suffered from for a long time, the fake news of blood libels, the fake news of ascribing guilt for assassinations, attempted assassinations. So Stalin decided to falsely accuse a group of prominent Jewish doctors. It was later accompanied by publications of anti-Semitic character in the media, which talked about the threats of Zionism and condemned people with Jewish names. If you carried a Jewish name, that in itself led to your potentially being oppressed. Doctors, officials, and others, Jews and non-Jews, were promptly dismissed from their jobs, were arrested. And a few weeks after Stalin's death, the new leadership stated a lack of evidence. The case was dropped. And soon after, it was admitted that the entire case was a fabrication. So after the fact, they were vindicated, but that didn't prevent, during the episode itself, the horrible trauma and suffering. By the 1950s, Jews in the USSR were being forced to assimilate and suffered what many called a spiritual strangulation. Because again, there was the paranoia of the Jew was targeted, the Jew was demeaned, the Jew was deprived, the Jew was persecuted, and the Jew was, most of all, the theory, again, of the Russians, as it has been of so many of our enemies, is that our life source, Gehem Chayenu Va'orach Yameinu, our very life source, our lifeblood is access to Torah study, access to a Torah lifestyle. If only we could prevent, if only we could outlaw the study of Torah and the living of Torah, we will force the Jews to be spiritually strangulated, resulting in their assimilation. Now, during this time, a large number of Soviet Jews understandably wanted out. If that was the condition, and if that was what was imposed on you, you'd want to emigrate, you'd want to move, you'd want to leave. They applied for exit visas to leave, especially in the period following the 1967 Six-Day War, when a groundswell of Jewish pride exploded around the world, including. In fact, it's an interesting historical footnote that the Jews of the USSR were on their way to assimilating, and the sweeping victory of the Six-Day War had an enormous impact in contributing to a groundswell of Jewish pride, of a renewal and interest in studying their Jewish identity, their Jewish background, what is happening. Communism prevented them. We were, some in this room were with us in June on our trip to Poland. And when we were in Krakow for Shabbos, we went to the JCC of Krakow. Believe it or not, their JCC may be more active than ours in Boca Raton. The JCC there is a hustling, bustling place with Torah study groups and young people. And those young people who are there, and we met some of them, know they're Jewish not for their 20 years of life or 25 years of life. Some of them just found out that week, that month, that year, because their parents or grandparents under communism had hid the fact that they were Jewish, didn't communicate that. On a deathbed, somebody admitted it. And these young people were curious and inquisitive to understand their Jewish background. In Russia, communism forced Jews underground. The spiritual strangulation was succeeding, trending towards assimilation. And one of the factors that contributed to a groundswell of interest in learning about their Judaism was the sweeping victory of the Six-Day War. During the Cold War, Soviet Jews were thought to be a security liability, possible traitors. And to apply for an exit visa, the applicant often would have to quit their job. That is an excellent deterrent to get somebody to apply for a visa. Unless you're absolutely confident you're going to successfully get the visa and be able to get out, you're not going to want to risk the unemployment, the lack of income. So if the prerequisite to applying for a visa were quitting your job, it was an excellent deterrent. In the years 1960, 1970 through 70, only 4,000 people legally emigrated from the USSR. You understand what a tiny number that is? You understand how insignificant and negligible that is. In the 70s, 163,000 Jews were allowed to emigrate. Also, a small number, a fraction of the great total who wanted to. By 1964, which is really the beginning, if you're trying to pinpoint a date, there's a pinpoint a date on our side, on our continent, that you can pinpoint a date in America, which actually began in, anyone know which city had the first effort and the first grassroots movement to want to protest, demonstrate, to make a move on freeing Soviet Jewry?
Cleveland.
Sam is 100% correct. It was Cleveland. And in the USSR, it was in Moscow. And in 1964, 15,000 Jews danced and were singing in front of the city's great choral synagogue at Simchas Torah. And the news that Jews in Russia had a swell of Jewish pride, Jewish identity, and were advocating for their own release is what inspired and motivated Jews who enjoyed freedom here to want to stand up on their behalf. May 1st, 1964, student struggle for Soviet Jewry, SSSJ, not the catchiest name in history, but it had a big effect nonetheless. One of the first grassroots groups protesting on behalf of Soviet Jewry held its founding demonstration. That was May 1st, 1964. I did not attend that particular demonstration. That was long before my time. Through the 60s, that was a joke, by the way, for the record. At the record note, that was long before. Through the 60s, these grassroots movements in the West and the USSR remained small. So for the first decade of their existence, they were small grassroots movements, but they were really stagnant. They weren't making a great impact. The event that transformed the movement into a global cause was the Leningrad hijackings. Anyone remember the Leningrad hijacking? What was the Leningrad hijacking? Jews from Riga and Leningrad were refused exit visas. They were among the early, what we call the refuseniks, a term, a label for those who wanted to leave and were being prevented. They hijacked, gutsy group of Jews, a small 12-seater plane, and they hijacked the plane not to hold hostages, not to make threats, not to, God forbid, be violent. They hijacked the plane simply in an effort to attain their freedom. The KGB was on to them from the very beginning, but the KGB slow-played it. They could have arrested them from the unfolding of the very plot, but they didn't. They followed them, and only on June 15, 1970, they arrested them on the tarmac. That was in June. In December, the Soviets organized a public trial. The public trial was a farce, but the public trial was the ability to, in a very public way, make an example out of these so-called hijackers, really just wanted their freedom, and to scare anyone else who might think of following in their footsteps. And the conclusion, the result of this trial, was that two of the leaders of the plot were sentenced to death. There was a great reaction. That's why I say, not I say, and I read many articles, I'm sorry I'm not attributing where I got much of this from, but that's why the historians show that this event, the Leningrad hijacking, was the crucial pivot point that took it from a grassroots movement, both in the USSR and here, from a few small, struggling, ineffective groups, that made it a global cause that began to gain real traction. Meir Kahana, Rabbi Kahana, said that he would kill two Russians for every Jew that was killed, which is consistent with his approach and philosophy. This motivated the Leningrad hijacking, and the conclusion of the trial that two would be put to death motivated 400 Jewish leaders to converge on the State Department, Capitol Hill, the Department of Justice, several foreign embassies, and the White House to urge President Nixon to press the Soviets to exonerate the hijackers and not to put the two to death. After a week and a half, the Soviets relented and commuted the death sentences. Now this is very significant because it proved that the activism and the efforts were effective. And the proof that they were affected only stimulated and motivated more of those efforts on their behalf. And organizations now formed. Rather than simply grassroots efforts of individuals, organizations began. You may remember them. The 70s, the movement grew, became a feature of American Jewish life. There was the National Conference on Soviet Jewry. On top, that's a picture of Yosef Mendelovich. You may not recognize him because he was younger, but he spoke in our shul a week and a half ago. I was away. I missed it. Those who were here, I hear it was outstanding. He's an extraordinary individual, one of the refuseniks who showed great spiritual resistance as a refusenik. I highly recommend his book. I think it's Unbroken Chain is the title. A really incredible individual. And the other major movement was the Union of Councils for Soviet Jewry. Again, clearly they didn't hire a PR firm to help them come up with their names and acronyms. And it proves how their drive was so powerful that despite the terrible names of their organizations, they had an impact nonetheless. 1964, the SSSJ, the Student Soviet Struggle for Soviet Jewry, was founded in New York by Jacob Birnbaum. That's a picture of him on top. It's hard to see. Sir Martin Gilbert. I wanted to quote him because last week I was in the Eretz Chaim Cemetery in Beit Shemesh, where Boker Ton Synagogue now has a new section. I was attending the unveiling of my grandparents, who are actually the first two plots buried in the BRS section. Some of you may have attended. We had a session earlier tonight, an information session, as we're running out of plots in that section. We may buy more. But while I was driving to our section, I passed the kever of Sir Martin Gilbert. There he was. I was very interested to find him there. The Oxford historian who published extensively on Soviet Jewry wrote, quote, "As a cautious, pedantic historian, I'm naturally reluctant to call anyone the father of anything. but I have no hesitation whatever in describing Jacob Birnbaum as the father of the Soviet Jewry movement. And that is quite a haskama for Sir Martin Gilbert to ascribe that title, the father of the movement, to him. To give you a sense of what motivated and drove Birnbaum, anyone know where Birnbaum was from? He did not have a Brooklyn accent. Anyone know where he was from? England, the UK. And he moved to America and just happened to move to Washington Heights, which positioned him next to a great body of students, not at Breuer's, but at Yeshiva University, who became many of his partners in the formation and development of this movement. But to give you a sense of his philosophy and what drove him, Birnbaum sent a letter that said the following. I'll read you the quote. "Just as we as human beings and as Jews are conscious of the wrongs suffered by the Negro and we fight for his betterment, so must we come to feel in ourselves the silent, strangulated pain of so many of our Russian brethren. We who condemn silence and inaction during the Nazi Holocaust, dare we keep silent now? The time has come for a mass grassroots movement spearheaded by the student youth. A ferment is indeed at work at this time. There is a time to be passive and a time to act. We believe most emphatically that this is not a time for quietism. We believe that a bold, well-planned campaign to include some very active measures can create a climate of opinion, a moral power, which will become a force to be reckoned with. Last year, in our great rivalries, I did one of the classes on the debate between Stephen Wise and Peter Bergson, if you remember, which was the American Jewish response to the Holocaust. Rabbi Stephen Wise, who had very close relationship with the president and with government, advocated diplomacy, quiet, don't ruffle feathers, you'll incite anti-Semitism here. Whereas Peter Bergson, anyone know what his real name was? Hillel Cook. He was a nephew of the great Rav Cook. He changed his name partially to protect himself because of his activities and also to protect his uncle, that there not be backlash to his uncle, to Rav Cook. But Peter Bergson advocated, and really the whole AIPAC movement, the whole notion today of activism and lobbying and influence really can be credited to Peter Bergson. History has poskened that his approach was the more correct one. He had incredible influence. He rented out Madison Square Garden, and we covered this. But the Soviet Jewry movement, and you see from this letter from Birnbaum himself, was partially driven by how few joined Bergson's efforts and how ineffective it was, how unsuccessful they were. And we'll come back to this, but part of the Soviet Jewry movement, and you have to study a piece of history in context. So you have to study it within the context of the civil rights movement, in which there was a movement of activism trying to create change and freedom and equity. So you have to see it in the context of the civil rights movement, and you also have to see it in the shadow of the Holocaust. The now American Jews were not going to be passive, indifferent, complacent. They were not going to rely on quiet diplomacy, but Birnbaum was trying to incite them, to motivate them, to realize that they could and should be a force to be reckoned with. April 27, 1964, 250 Jewish students joined together at Columbia University for the first official gathering of the student struggle for Soviet Jewry. I think that actually was a wise thing to put student in the name, because part of what made it success, it was driven by young people. And we'll come back to this at the end when we talk about today, and that identifying the next Soviet Jewry movement of our time as a form of inreach, of trying to inspire and motivate our young people to belong, feel they belong to something bigger than themselves, is one of, to me, the important and great takeaways of this whole period of time. So I think he was onto something by putting student in the name. Within 4 days, a rally was held at the Soviet mission in Manhattan and was attended. It started with 250. 4 days later, there were 1,100 people at that rally. Another effort, in addition to the two national organizations, was the Jewish Defense League. Who was the founder and leader of the Jewish Defense League? Rav Meir Kahana, Hashem Yikom Damo. In its early years, the Jewish Defense League, headed by Meir Kahana, used to follow and harass Soviet diplomats stationed in the United States. They were not quiet diplomacy. They were not nonviolent civil disobedience or demonstrations. They were, I won't call it violent, but they harassed. They harassed, and they tried to make a commotion, and they tried to make a scene. When Soviet performers visited the United States, whether they were a small string quartet or a world-renowned ballet, they were greeted by Jewish pickets demanding rights for Soviet Jews. Each of these represented units in the Soviet Jewry Movement Army. And every army needs multiple units. The pro-Israel army of today needs multiple units, needs an AIPAC and a JNF and a ZOA and an honest reporting and the list goes on and on. And the Soviet Jewry Movement had multiple national organizations working in parallel, including the Jewish Defense League. Do you know who one of the earliest participants, staunch participants of the Jewish Defense League was? Partially formed his Jewish identity. We're going to see a quote from him soon. Someone whose writings I admire. He spoke here for Shabbos a couple years ago. I actually just saw him when I was in Israel two times ago. Yossi Klein Halevi. Yossi Klein Halevi, the book Like Dreamers. He's such a gentle and sweet and lovable man, a brilliant mind. It's hard to picture him as part of this movement, but he was. Soviet leadership made no concessions. Despite the grassroots effort having turned global, am I blocking you this whole time? Presumably hoping that the Jewish community would grow discouraged, they would give up. But after the Six-Day War, the mood of Soviet Jewry changed markedly. As we referenced earlier, thousands and then tens of thousands began to study Jewish history and texts, attend Simchas Torah celebrations, apply for immigration visas, and by the early 1970s, many were receiving permission. So the Six-Day War was a turning point, not in the effort from a grassroots movement to a global one, but the impact it began to have. Because the Soviets could no longer hope that the Jews would simply assimilate, that they would successfully spiritually strangle them. They realized that it was actually going in the opposite direction. Jews in the USSR were not assimilating, but rather they were revisiting their Jewish roots, they were swelling with Jewish pride, they were investigating what it meant to be a Jew. The next significant mark, the Jackson-Vanik Amendment. Legislation that would make any trade relationship with the Soviet Union contingent on a freeing up emigration. So the Soviet Jewry movement, in addition to demonstrations, and in addition to harassing Soviet visitors and officials, decided to also use one of the great, if not the greatest tool at our disposal, which is legislation, policy. How do you make a difference? This is again the AIPAC model, lobbying to change legislation and to change policy. And they lobbied and they created the Jackson-Vanik Amendment. What was this legislation? The legislation was no trade and no aid to the Soviet Union until Soviet Jews are free. It was connecting emigration, trying to force the hand of the Soviets to loosen their emigration policies for Jews as a precondition for trade with the United States. Do you know who one of the biggest obstacles, reading ahead you know, but if you haven't read ahead, one of the biggest obstacles to the passing of the Jackson-Vanik Amendment and this legislative success was a fellow Jew, none other than Henry Kissinger. Those who lived through it and confronted his opposition knew it all these years. But 8 years ago, in 2010, tapes were released in which Kissinger is heard telling Nixon in 1973 that helping Soviet Jews emigrate and escape oppression by a totalitarian regime, a huge issue, was, quote, not an objective of American foreign policy. Now, I disagree, you disagree, we're shocked, but you could defend his role as a national security advisor at the time to say that this issue of this small group of Jews behind the Iron Curtain is not the foreign policy issue of the United States. I'm not agreeing with it, I'm not defending it, but you could understand it. The next quote, however, quote, and if they put Jews into gas chambers in the Soviet Union, it is not an American concern, maybe a humanitarian concern. Maybe a humanitarian concern? That was Kissinger's opposition. But eventually, at the beginning of 1975, after 2.5 year battle, 2.5 years it took in order to get the votes, 2.5 year battle to get the Jackson-Vanik Amendment signed into law. And that was another victory if you're trying to track the milestones in the success of the Soviet Jewry movement. The Leningrad hijacking was won, and it propelled more efforts, and the Six-Day War had a big impact, and the passing of this amendment was enormous as well. Do people remember this? Remember lobbying for it? Remember the amendment?
You bet.
Okay. Many prominent refuseniks, but none are more well known than Natan Sharansky. Arrested in 77, put on trial the summer of 78, he was sentenced to 13 years in prison. 86, he was let go. It was one of the first signs that the Soviet Union was changing its attitude. Gorbachev was looking for rapprochement with the West. Reagan made it clear, as had the American Jewish community, that freeing up emigration would be the price. That the price for Gorbachev to have access, inroads with the West, recognition to advance his interests, would be loosening the hand on emigration from the Iron Curtain. And so in 86, Sharansky was let go. But that year, even though Sharansky was one of the few who was let go, that year the number overall was still pretty small. 914 Soviet Jews were permitted to leave in 86. So the effort, the movement was having an impact and effect, but still not enormous. I mean, think about how many former USSR Jews have moved to Israel?
2 million.
It's over 2 million. So you talk about 914, you're talking about nothing, a negligible number. Clearly the fist was still tight in the Iron Curtain. Quick video, because this is a period that we can still capture with images and sound, I'm trying to communicate through teaching, but also share this video if you're listening online. I apologize, you'll hear but can't see.
This is a love story that brought down the Soviet Empire and freed millions of Jews. Natan Sharansky, human rights activist, Zionist, and refusenik, fighting for his right to be a free Jew.
I was haunted, I was arrested sometimes, persecuted in different forms.
He also fought for the love of his life, Avital.
מאוד נמשכתי לבחור הזה, לשמחה שבעיניו, לחופש שהיה בעיניו, ולאומץ לב כזה, לעמוד מול שם בחצי, בצד השני של הרחוב, עמדו אנשי KGB.
But on the eve of their wedding, they were cruelly separated by the Soviet regime.
אני מוזמנת פתאום למשרד של הוויזות. והם אומרים, אם את לא עוזבת, לעולם לא תצאי, לא את ולא חתנך. אני מחליטה פה בשבילי שאני לא אצא מרוסיה עד שאני אראה את נתן, ועד שאנחנו נתחתן.
היינו בטוחים שזה ייקח כמה חודשים עד שנהיה ביחד. זה לקח 12 שנה.
A short while later, in a trumped-up trial, Sharansky is accused of being a traitor to the Soviet regime and sentenced to 13 years of hard labor. Sharansky's last words to the court.
בסוף אמרתי שכמו שיהודים במשך אלפים שנה היו אומרים אחד לשני לשנה רבה בירושלים, ככה אני אומר עכשיו לאביטל, לישראל ולעם שלנו לשנה רבה בירושלים, ולמשפט אין לי מה להגיד.
For 9 years, Sharansky sits alone in a punishment cell in Siberia, while Avital runs a worldwide campaign to free him.
אביטל הגיעה כולה נסערת ורגשת, היא אמרה, אנטולי נמק בכלא, הסובייטים ייתנו לו למות.
She garners the support of world Jewry and international leaders, including U.S. President Ronald Reagan. On February 11th, 1986, the world holds its breath as Natan Sharansky walks to freedom.
I think of the sight of Natan Sharansky, still in the dominion of his KGB captors, zigzagging his way across the tarmac after they ordered him to walk a straight line.
On that same historic day, Sharansky arrives in the land of Israel, to the joy of his mother and wife, to thousands of rejoicing Israelis and Jews around the world.
Anatoly Sharansky has fought heroically, alone, under tremendous pressure, as a proud Jew, as a freedom-loving person, as a man with a mission, as a devoted Zionist, and showed that you can arrest a body, you cannot put in prison a spirit. Faith prevails.
After his release, Sharansky continues his struggle for the freedom of Soviet Jewry. Natan Sharansky, the hero who inspired a generation, minister in 4 consecutive Israeli governments, the only foreign recipient of both the Congressional Medal of Honor and the Presidential Medal of Freedom, never loses sight of his mission.
I want to tell to all the Jews of the world that we together, Jews of all the world, are very strong.
Today, 25 years after his liberation as chairman of the Jewish Agency for Israel, Sharansky carries his message forcefully and with the same passion to the Jewish people.
I want every Jew in the world to feel as I felt. If you want to fight for the better future, you must first of all to be proud Jew, connected to your people. And while we have big external challenges, Jewish Agency concentrates on no less important challenge for strengthening Jewish identity, for strengthening connection of every Jew in the world with their heritage, with their community, with the State of Israel, and as a result, to inspire and to empower Jewish people in their struggle for our family and for our state.
And there are incredible stories. I'm not going to take the time now. As I said, this could be a 10-part series on the Soviet Jewry movement. Yosef Mendelovich, Natan Sharansky, telling the stories of these extraordinary people, their heroes, how they defied their captors, their enemies, how they maintained their spirit, even in solitary confinement and conditions we can't begin to imagine, is something really extraordinary. December 6, 1987, the next major milestone in this movement is Gorbachev was scheduled to come on his first visit to Washington for a summit with Reagan, and a massive rally, a massive demonstration was scheduled. Now, it was in under 30 days, under 3 weeks, I think, that they scheduled the rally. How many people here were at that rally? Kol HaKavod. Beautiful. It took a very short period of time. I know today, when we have tools like the internet, and we have tools like email, and we have tools like social media, that if I went to the umbrella groups who held that rally and said, in 3 weeks, let's try to schedule a rally in Washington on behalf of Israel, there would be great resistance. They didn't have those tools. And in a very short time, they scheduled a rally, having no clue how many people would come. They hoped maybe 50,000, maybe 100,000. In the end, 250,000 showed up. 250,000, sending a strong message to the Soviets. And that's what really launched the exodus from the former Soviet Union. By the end of the 80s, the large majority of Soviet Jews applying to emigrate were being permitted to do so. And here's a quick video taking you back to that rally and to that time.
The Soviet Jewry movement recognized that Jews in the Soviet Union were being badly mistreated.
We were discriminated against. There were no Jewish schools, there were no opportunity to go to synagogues.
Jews were not only deprived of their freedom, they were deprived of their identity.
There was a belief that Gorbachev would come to the United States. What were we going to do? How were we going to respond, galvanize?
The Federation movement recognized this was an important moment in Jewish history and a potential turning point.
This was not an event where you RSVP'd and we knew how many people were coming for dinner.
With only 32 days, one might think that federations would have shied away from such a formidable challenge. But the fact is, within moments, federations recognized they could do this.
There was no internet, there was no CNN, but there was a huge flood of American Jews.
On December 6, 1987, American Jews organized this incredible rally.
250,000 plus Jews and non-Jews gathered in Washington to show support and to demand freedom for Soviet Jews.
As we got into this and began to sense momentum, the formulation that we used was, we think will be the largest Jewish gathering in Washington history.
The march started at the Ellipse, which is behind the White House, and marched down Constitution Avenue.
you could see a vast number of people and signs from various communities throughout the United States.
Michael and Sergei, who was about 14 at the time, went to the march, and they were really excited about it.
You know, the crowd was very, I think, was very patient. And I think the reason was because they knew they were part of something historic.
And it's a story not only of rescue and bringing people to freedom, but also of how we're all connected.
When you liberate people, when you give them pathways to freedom, you don't just benefit them. All the world benefits from that.
The impact of those former Soviet Jews is tremendous. 5 Nobel Prize winners, numerous medical innovations, Google. I mean, tremendous impact.
I think it's Jewish Federation have been instrumental in this. They really catapulted the whole issue to the front pages, to the front of the minds of every household of the Jewish community here.
Federations have the unique ability to respond by finding Jews in their local communities and making them realize they're part of something far larger than just their individual concerns.
Freedom 25 is an effort to elevate understanding of the Soviet Jewry movement and the lessons that it has for contemporary times and for the future.
Freedom 25 has a great opportunity to remind the American Jew.
Them is an amazing gift, a very fragile gift, and we need to know why we have it and how not to destroy it.
When people care, they get involved. When they get involved, they make a difference. And we have to continue to make a difference.
We must be committed to justice, not just for Jews, but for all people.
The moment you rediscover this connection between your daily life, this long, interesting, and exciting history, it gives you a lot of strength.
If I took it for granted back then that Jews could sing together, I no longer take it for granted. It's embedded and imprinted in me as a memory of Jewish peoplehood.
I think back to those times when we were able to put aside our differences and come together for the greater good. And my hope is that if we have to, we'll be able to do that again.
Should I give you one guess who produced that video? Federation produced that about 5 years ago, but I think it's a good summary of that rally that some or many of you attended, 250,000. The closest I came was shortly after I arrived in Boca, during the Second Intifada, there was a rally that had 100,000 Jews in Washington for Israel. Rabbi Brander, I was working for him in the Kollel at the time, and he actually gave me this project. We chartered a plane. We took a whole plane from here. I don't know if any of you were with us or remember that, and went to Washington for that day. 100,000, which is less than half, and I remember feeling like that was like standing at Har Sinai. I can only imagine 250,000 Jews united by one cause, one mission, and one goal was a very, very powerful experience, and it had an impact. It also drew the attention of the world, the Soviets in particular, who listened, who heard, and who changed their policy. The vice president at the time spoke at that rally. Anyone remember the vice president? It was George Bush, the older George Bush, spoke at the rally, as well as many other dignitaries and many other elected officials. Here's a great quote from Yossi Klein Halevi. I referenced earlier, that's him holding the placard in the front. I am my brother's keeper, a very young Yossi Klein Halevi. And a great article that he has reflecting on the Soviet Jewry movement, he says the following. By the mid-70s, a transformed Jewish establishment was leading the movement. Thanks to Jackson Vanek, a new generation of Jewish leaders learned how to lobby Congress, and no less important, how to resist White House pressure. Jackson Vanek was the moment that American Jewry repudiated the legacy of Rabbi Stephen Wise, the preeminent American Jewish leader during the Holocaust, who failed to challenge Roosevelt on Jewish rescue. Through the Soviet Jewry movement, moreover, a beautiful symbiotic relationship emerged between the freest Jews in the diaspora and the most oppressed. By publicly expressing their solidarity with Soviet Jews, American Jews overcame their inhibitions and assumed their place within American society as a self-confident community. The courage shown today by American Jewish leaders in standing with Israel against the growing effort to delegitimize it And to stand against an administration intent on weakening the American-Israeli relationship is a legacy of the Soviet Jewry movement. That was not written in the last year, year and a half. But Yossi Klein Halevi is observing as a historian that it was the success of the Soviet Jewry movement which really planted the seeds for what we take for granted today. Young people today, we bring a lot of students on APAC. The idea that you lobby an elected official, the idea that you hold a demonstration or a protest, the idea that you tackle and object to an issue that you're unhappy with or try to influence legislation is something we take for granted. But it wasn't so before the Soviet Jewry movement. And to Yossi Klein Halevi, that is one of the major takeaways. The Soviet Jewry movement forged strong Jewish identity, and it gave Jewish self-confidence, the Jewish community self-confidence, that we have a voice and it could be effective. Some of the major leaders, founders and leaders of the SSSJ, names you recognize. Malcolm Hohnlein, a young Malcolm Hohnlein, a young Rav Aaron Lichtenstein Zatzal, Yibodeh L'Chaim Tovim V'Aruchim Rabbi Lam, Rabbi Avi Weiss, Rabbi Shlomon Riskin, Rabbi Abram Joshua Heschel. Many of the names of activists, rabbinic activists, who we think of, really did not, were not raised in a vacuum, but the roots of their activism was their participation as students or as young adults in the early part of this movement. Not everybody agreed. Not everybody agreed with the methodology of public protests and of drawing attention in a public way. Perhaps most staunchly opposed to this method was none other than the Lubavitcher Rebbe of Menachem Mendel Schneerson Zatzal. From the inception of the communist oppression, it was Chabad that kept the flame of Jewish life alive. The Rebbe's opposition was not because he didn't care about Jews behind the Iron Curtain. It can be argued that nobody cared more about Jews behind the Iron Curtain, and nobody did more to provide for them than the Lubavitcher Rebbe. As the former Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir, who for years was in the Mossad, said in 1994, quote, "In the 50s, when we began to send our agents to Russia, we discovered a secret network that reached into every Jewish community. It was operated by the Lubavitcher Rebbe. When the Mossad got to Russia, they had to tap into the existing network, and the network was created and reported to the Rebbe. When Lishkas HaKesher, the secret arm of the Israeli Prime Minister's office, began to orchestrate public confrontation in the West, the Rebbe demanded they be restrained. Based on his knowledge of Russia, he felt it would endanger Jews in the Soviet Union. Prime Minister Eshkol was considering accepting the view, but he died in office, and the new Prime Minister, Golda Meir, was not receptive to the idea." The Rebbe had unbelievable influence in Israeli leadership and among American leadership as well. And the Rebbe's opinion on this was going to carry the day in Israel, if not for the passing of Levi Eshkol and the ascension of Golda Meir. But the Rebbe felt, and he felt he knew Russia well, that the Russians would not react by pressure publicly. That would actually only make them dig their heels in and take it out even more on Soviet Jewry. And therefore the Rebbe was a great advocate for quiet diplomacy behind the scenes rather than public demonstration. He was not against activism. He thought it was bolstering the Jewish identity in the U.S. and that was a great positive outcome, but the road to freedom was through quiet diplomacy. He was involved in behind the scenes dealings with Reagan and Gorbachev in an effort, some thought, to have paved the way for Jews to leave Russia. In sharp opposition to the protests, in a major address that he gave in a Fabrengen in 1971, the Rebbe said, quote, "May the one who sits upon the high protect Russian Jewry from those who cause disruptions in order to supposedly help them, but whose hearts are oblivious to what constitutes real help and what causes the opposite effect. It is imperative instead to advance secret initiatives like those that until now have brought substantive results." The Rebbe probably felt partially that he's been the one doing this until they all woke up to it. Now they woke up to it, they're going to undo his success, and their method is likely to cause more damage than good. A ally of the Lubavitcher Rebbe, who was staunchly opposed to the public demonstration, who liked the Rebbe early on before it was popular, was going into the Soviet Union to smuggle in goods and to teach Torah, was Rabbi Pinchas Teitz Zatzal. 1908 to 1995, Rav Teitz was and is maybe one of the few who even posthumously remains the Mor D'Asr of Elizabeth, New Jersey, was making efforts since the 50s to maintain a connection. 65, he traveled regularly to the Soviet Union, teaching classes to local Jews, distributing Jewish religious books. He also cultivated relationships with Russian officials and he was actually criticized by the activists in America why he was developing those relationships, as if, first of all, part of history repeats itself. I don't know if there were any memos about Rabbi Teitz's relationship with the Russian officials. They were leaked, they were not leaked. It's a picture of Rabbi Teitz and the Lubavitcher Rebbe, who had little in common in terms of the yeshiva training. Anyone know where Rabbi Teitz went to yeshiva? Rabbi Teitz was a product. If you knew Rabbi Teitz, his regal dress, the way he carried himself with such dignity, then you knew that Rabbi Teitz learned in which yeshiva? Slabodka, a classmate of Rav Huttner and Rav Ruderman, and of the great leaders of the 20th century who learned in Slabodka. But on this issue, the Rebbe and Rabbi Teitz were allies. In fact, Birnbaum would comment that, quote, Rabbi Teitz was a thorn in our side for many years. These were parallel paths. Birnbaum had his student organization with public demonstrations, Rabbi Teitz with diplomacy like the Rebbe. Where did the rub fall? He never came out publicly as a supporter of public demonstrations, nor did he come out against them. The Rav did not weigh in. His brother, Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, did take an open stand in favor of activism in regard to Soviet Jewry, civil rights, and the Vietnam War as well. But the Rav, Rav Yosef Dov, Rav Yashaber Soloveitchik, did not take a public stance or a public position in any way. And that's this last subject that I want to spend our remaining time on. For those of you who have source sheets, we're going to look through these source sheets. Those of you who don't, I'm happy to get them to you, or they'll be online with the class later this evening. In the Torah journal HaPardes, the editor of HaPardes, the last issue I want to study with you is this question of the demonstrations. What was at the core of why the Rebbe and Rabbi Teitz were against it? Why other rabbis backed it and were for it? What was the debate? And who was right? Which method proved to be effective? 1965, Rabbi Simcha Elberg. Rabbi Simcha Elberg lived in Warsaw, got smicha from Rav Menachem Zemba, was part of the Mir detour to Shanghai during the Holocaust, lived in New York, and was the editor of the Torah journal HaPardes. He lived from 1915 to 1995. And in that journal HaPardes, this is in 1965, he has this entry, Hafganot Hefkarot Neged Rusya HaSovietit, demonstrations against Russia. And he writes, this is a long source book, so we won't have time to read everything, but he writes, if you look where I underline, Yesh Lomar B'Kol Ram, one should shout from the rooftops, Alanu Larshus B'Shum Panim Shekol Arot La'Argein Minei Afganos Ke'ila Yavav Ya'Argein. God forbid that we allow anyone who wants to convene a demonstration to do so. Hafganos Ha'Ileim Tragiot U'Mesuchanot Ma'od. These demonstrations shouldn't be lauded or celebrated. They are tragic and they are dangerous. Now again, we have the benefit of hindsight, which, last I checked, is still 2020. So we look and say, what do you mean the demonstrations caused the fall of the Iron Curtain? Jews were allowed to emigrate. 2 to 3 million moved to Israel. What are you talking about? But he's writing, without the benefit of hindsight, he's writing in 1965. And his interpretation of current events is that demonstrations will backfire. He says, "Ha-studentim ha-chafshiyim," I understand why the irreligious students, they're not asking anyone, so they're having these demonstrations. "Ha-studentim b'nei ha-yeshivos min ha-echer sh'anu nishal b'koram," but the observant, the Torah students who are participating in these demonstrations, "mi b'kesh zos mi'etchem," who asked you to do it? And who told you you can do these dangerous activities? We pose this question with every strength and sharpness and bitterness. Who told you you could do this? And he goes on, those attending the demonstration are not only of the halachic status of a rodef, a pursuer, but you might be murderers. If one Jew in Russia is persecuted and dies because of a demonstration in Manhattan, it's on your hands, he writes. Again, 1965. This is not after the fact. This is not evaluating it after the fact. And he goes on and on. Last line, She'ela zu shel ergun machos pumbios neged Rusya, this question of public protests, Sheilas Pikuach Nefesha, Nogas Lemilyonim. You're talking about millions of people's lives pikuach nefesh, not a shayla of pikuach nefesh of one, a shayla of pikuach nefesh of millions. He says, who do you have a psak from? Who did you ask a shayla from? And then he says, and this is what I wanted to bring to your attention, 1965. This is an individual who ran away with the yeshiva of Nir to Shanghai. He understood the Nazi oppression. And he says, and if you'll tell me, Hitler, don't begin to compare it. Don't dare compare it to Hitler. Ani Omer, this is what I'll tell you. Gam az, Shlomeinu Mechir Ayom Avur Yashtika, we paid a great price. Right? We look at Bergson as the hero and Stephen Wise as the villain. He, in 1965, said Bergson was the villain. Because who knows how many were killed by the Nazis because of the protests in America. Halavai v'ayinu yodim lishto gam az. I wish they would have been silent then too, he writes. Shocking, no? 1965, he's writing that I wish even in the Holocaust the American Jews would have been silent. Ki az yitachen ki Hitler lo yahofeich l'chaya ayuma v'torefes kazu. Because it was those public protests outside of Eastern Europe which helped transform Hitler into that animal. Halavai v'hayinu az meragei harishon mirega harishon shel hashtadluso shel Hitler mishtamshem b'tachsis hayashan noshan shelanu hishtadla shel shochad. Halavai, the shtadlan, since the 1700s, the Jews used the method of the shtadlan. Who was the shtadlan? This was a position, a paid position, an advocate who did diplomacy on behalf of the Jews. Publicly, the Jews were the most loyal and quiet and passive citizens, and the shtadlan advocated their interests behind the scenes. And here writes the editor of Hapardes, Rav Simcha Elberg, in 1965, halavai the Jews, even in the Holocaust, would have used a shtadlan and would have bribed. And halavai they wouldn't have. In other words, who's he endorsing in the Holocaust? He's endorsing Rav Aaron Cutler, the Vad Hatzala, Rav Irving Bunim, who the methodology there was to raise money and to bribe, to pay off, to get Jews released from the Nazis. And he, in 1965, is saying, the protesters against the Holocaust, you caused more aggression by the Nazis. You should have done the same method of shochad and shtadlanos, of bribing officials to get out. So in 65, he's weighing in. 65, remember, is early on. This is before the mass protests and demonstrations. This is before it's a global movement when it's still grassroots. 10 years later, 1975. Also in Hapardes. Page 3. Rav Moshe Feinstein, who's the Nasi of the Agudas HaRabbonim, Rav Moshe Zatzal, is serving as the head of this prestigious group of rabbis. And he says, lest you think that we've changed our position on the protests, know that we still maintain Rav Aaron Cutler and Gedolei Eretz Yisrael shelo lakachas chelek pi'il b'mitzayim u'pu'ulos mesuyam m'shechoshim ki ayadam yazru liyadas Rusya. Don't participate in the demonstrations and protests. It will not accomplish what they're telling you it will. We don't participate. It will backfire, he writes in 1975. 1987. Lastly, in Hapardes. Now, 1987. What happens in 1987? December 6, 1987, was the mass rally in Washington. So, Hapardes Journal has the following entry: the Agudas HaRabbonim, Yadus HaTorah lo ishtatfa b'afganos hamcha b'Washington negin Michael Gorbachev. The Torah community should not participate in the protests in Washington opposing Gorbachev. And he writes, look at the second paragraph. Ba'odata shel Agudas HaRabbonim ne'emar, p'niyaseinu l'kol Yehudi Amerika li'imona mi'irgan afganot v'shayos neged Rusya, ha'soviet be'ayis ha'bikur ha'rashmi shamar Gorbachev Washington. We're calling on Jews not to participate in the protests being planned in Washington. B'miyuchad ba'olam ha'torani, particularly in the Torah community, lo rak ba'America, Gam Baratos Acheros in other countries as well. Be Israel and Israel, Baratos Europa, Ubuchomakum Shadibarna Shadvarinu Higia. Wherever this word arrives, we're telling you not to participate. That was the will of Rav Aaron Kotler, Rav Moshe Feinstein, and the Agudas HaRabbonim, including all of the Admorim. It's interesting how this united the Haredi community all of a sudden. The Litvish community united with the Hasidish community. You look at the next paragraph. Yishlut Sayyin, it's worth pointing out, Ki afachad min ha'admorim, sha'alfei alfei chasidim noharim achareim. Not one of the Rebbes who have thousands of followers. If you really want to get a rally, you got to get the Hasidim. Because with one comment by a Rebbe, you overnight. There's a reason that elected officials lobby in Flatbush and Williamsburg and Monroe and New Square, because you influence blocks of votes. And you could also influence blocks of protesters. And yet, none of them attended. Lubavitch, Satmar, Bubov, Kloisenberg, Munkach, Skver, none of them were there. And in 1987, before December 6th, calling, obviously, within 32 days, because that's how long it was planned, this Hapardes volume obviously came out in a timely fashion not to attend. So there was this great debate. The Rebbe said not to go. Rabbi Teit said not to go. In fact, if you quick look at an article, if you skip to page 17, this is the JTA, the Jewish Telegraph, October 11th, 1968. What's the headline? Rabbi Teitz differs with conference on Soviet Jewry on Simchas Torah demonstrations. Rabbi Teitz's opposition was not private. It's a whole article in the JTA how Rabbi Teitz publicly was disagreeing with the demonstrations and also believed the same thing as Rav Moshe and as the Agudas HaRabbonim. Rabbi Teitz said that where's the quote? But basically, if you encourage these demonstrations, it will be taken out on the Russian Jews and will actually accomplish the opposite of what we're trying. So you have Rabbi Teitz, Lubavitcher Rebbe, Rav Moshe, Rabbi Aaron Kotler, Yaakov Kamenetsky, the Agudas HaRabbonim, who are all saying public demonstrations is not the way to go. What about from a halachic perspective? So there was a tshuva written by Rav Yehuda Herzl Henkin, who's a grandson of the great Rav Henkin, the posek from New York in the early 20th century. So his grandson, who's alive today, tragically his son was murdered by terrorists, Rav Yehuda Herzl Henkin and Rabbanit Henkin, the head of Nishmat, their son, Hashem Yikom Damo, and his wife, who were driving from a simcha, and they were shot and murdered by terrorists just a few years ago. So Rav Henkin has a series of tshuvas of responsa called Shailos Tshuvas B'nei Bonim, and in Simon Nun Aleph he has the following tshuva: Hafganot Laman Yehudei Rusya, demonstrations on behalf of Russian Jewry. He wrote this tshuva on the fifth day of Hanukkah, which was December 21st, 1987, after the massive rally in Washington. But writing a tshuva, was it correct? Was it not correct, right or incorrect? So I want to teach you a little bit of Torah before you go home tonight. So let's look at this tshuva quickly. And here, Rav Henkin brings fascinating sources to our attention. Acharei asher matzlachem sheilas odos hafganos laman yudei Rusya bechlal v'afgana gdola beWashington hamakor lafkin. What is, do we have any Torah source that endorses the idea of a demonstration? Do we have a Jewish idea of a demonstration? Maybe where do we belong? In shul. Zugging Tehillim. How do we demonstrate? With a Gemara. With a Tehillim. Is there such a Jewish concept as a Hafgana? A demonstration. So, Rav Henkin points us to the Gemara in Rosh Hashanah, Daf Yutes, Tainus Yurches, as well. And there the Gemara says the following story. Be'asrim v'tamanya be'asa b'shurus ha'tavas l'yudoid l'yudun mi'oraisa. The Romans had enacted a decree that Jews could not learn Torah nor give a bris milah, nor observe Shabbos. What did these great rabbis do? They went to get advice of a dignitary. There was a Roman woman who had a position of stature. She advised the Roman leaders. So they went to get her advice how to overturn this Roman enactment that Jews can no longer study Torah, observe Shabbos, or give bris milah. Amr Lahem, what was her advice? Bo hifkinu balayla. Go and hifkinu, hafkana. Make a protest. When should the protest be? Balayla. Amru, shamayim lo achecha manachnu, velo b'nei avachar anachnu, velo b'nei emach asanachnu. Manashtaninu mikoluma shatem gozim alin exeris koshas. And what you should say in your protest is that we're not your brothers, we're not of the same father, we're not of the same mother, but what makes us different than every other nation that has its rights? Don't we have our rights? Ad kan, that's the Gemara. Says Rav Henkin, Hare Shigambi mea Gemara hefkinu. What you see is that public demonstrations go back at least to the time of the Gemara. Don't pay attention. Anyone who says that a hafgana is inconsistent with Torah is an ignoramus. They're ignorant. They don't know the Gemara Rosh Hashanah, the Gemara Tainus, that our rabbis protested to earn equality, religious freedom. So the question is not whether hafganot, whether protests, have a source in Torah. The only question is whether modern day demonstrations are the same as the hafganot that were done then. He makes a diuk that she says, she doesn't say go and protest, she says come and protest. Because she lived where the protest should happen. She was instructing them. She lived among the aristocracy. Page 6. Do it at night. Why at night? The Maharsha explains. It's an interesting tshuva. I encourage you to learn it on your own, but the hour is getting late. So let's just look at the parts relevant to tonight's topic. So it's unclear. They asked her what they should do. She gave the protest. Did they ask her advice on what to write on the placards? Did she offer the advice on what to write on the placards? He says, Rav Henkin, that it's clear to him from the Gemara that the Hafganah was not the first step. First, they tried diplomacy. It was only the failure of diplomacy. They went to her for advice, and she said, do a Hafganah. They probably got the women and children to go to the Hafganah. The cries of the women were more likely to appeal to the sympathy of the person who heard it. She said, come at night. Lashon Nekeva was a hint, bring the women and children as well. He has a number of diukim here. Fine. So now he writes, now he gets to our question. The left-hand column, page 6. Now let's get back to our question. It's been 60 years, he writes in 1987, the Jews have been forbidden from learning Torah in Russia. This is the exact equivalent of the story in the Gemara. They weren't allowed to keep Shabbos, they weren't allowed to give bris, and they weren't allowed to learn Torah. It's the same story. And in the Gemara, what was the advice, ostensibly followed by the rabbis? Protest. We gather in a public place. And the large gathering tries to make an impact. And the Hafgana is publicized through every means. And it came back to the leadership of Russia. Even if they were not protesting in Russia itself, with the media today, he writes in 87, the Russians were aware of the demonstration as if it happened there. So what is his conclusion? Page 7. He says, so you'll tell me, in Hapardes they publicized that in 1975, Rav Moshe Feinstein said, don't go to these demonstrations. How can you, Rav Henkin, say that you should go to Washington and go in the demonstration? So he writes, I love this language. Where I put the star, the asterisk. The notion of a hafgana has a Talmudic source. It's not a question of whether it's permissible in Torah to have a hafgana. What's the only question left is whether it's prudent, whether it will be effective, whether it's wise. So you're going to impose on me the opinion of someone from 12 years ago? Rav Moshe right then in 1975. Who's to say that Rav Moshe would agree today in 1987? And now he says, V'chein shamati mechasno, and I heard from his son-in-law. Who's his son-in-law? Rav Moshe Tendler. Shechamav loya oser hayom. That Rav Moshe would not have asked it today in 1987. I'm not, because of the testimony of his son-in-law, going to tell you it's enough to publicize that Rav Moshe endorses the rally, but it's enough to say that you can't assume that Rav Moshe would object to the rally. And he says the same thing is true with Rav Yaakov, and the same thing was true about my grandfather. And he says, listen to this great line, U'be'emes, Hagedolim yodim l'shanos es daitam, aval haktanim ein lehem das. Gedolim know how to change their mind. Small people never had a mind to begin with. Gedolim yodim l'shanos es daitam, ketanim ein lehem das, ve'enam yodim l'shanos. V'tolim atzim v'das gedolim b'zmanu v'makum, shalolim lo divru, v'harbe kikulim novim mizeh. You're going to take something someone said and you're going to apply it to a different period which they didn't say it? Who's to say the Gadol would have come to the same conclusion today? So therefore, his conclusion is attending a demonstration is perfectly halachic, it has a basis in the Torah, and if it seems to be effective, it's the right thing. He does, however, add, to say you're obligated to go halachically because it's pidyon shvuyim and lo samar adam reyecha, I won't say that because they don't have religious freedom in Russia. That's not the same thing as being pidyon shvuyim. That's his opinion, and that is his halachic analysis. A few other quick sources, and I will let you go. Rabbi Riskin recently wrote his memoir a couple years ago called Listening to God, and he has a few pages, a few chapters, his involvement in the Soviet Jewry movement. So here's what he writes. He talks about his relationship. First of all, 3 million Jews were behind the Iron Curtain. Elie Wiesel wrote a book, The Jews of Silence, to describe their life there. In the early 60s, I met a fascinating Englishman named Jacob Birnbaum, a Herzlian figure with fire in his eyes and passion in his heart. His grandfather was the very famous Nathan Birnbaum, a leading Baal Tshuva intellectual who coined the word Zionism. Birnbaum returned from a fact-finding mission to the Soviet Union. He took in disguise. He was highly charged with the necessity of activism work on their behalf. He envisioned worldwide demonstrations that would force the Soviets. He writes, the religious establishment was against activists. They felt it best to work through quiet diplomacy. A number of important rabbinic figures, Rabbi Teitz, were then visiting Soviet Union regularly and managed to bring in matzahs for Pesach, shofros. It was believed that any activist demonstrations would endanger what they were now succeeding in doing in conjunction. But I felt we had to learn from the mistakes we had made at the time of the Holocaust. I believe that Jacob was right. I went to consult with my Rebbe, Rabbi Soloveitchik, about the advisability of this activist approach on behalf of Soviet Jews. And the Rav responded in a way that has crucially affected my whole philosophy of halacha. Quote, I don't understand, I'm not going to do my Rav voice. I don't understand why you're asking me, he said. You have to ask a top Sovietologist. I didn't know there was such a thing. He impressed upon me that when one is dealing with issues that are not necessarily halachic issues discussed by the rabbis in the Talmud and Rishonim, issues that have to do with historical and sociological trends, one must go to experts in the field. I met with Professor Goldhagen, a leading Sovietologist of the day who taught at Harvard, and when I reported back on the result of my search, the Rav gave his blessing for activist demonstrations. So that is Rabbi Rifkin's testimony as to the Rav's position and attitude that it's not a halachic issue. Speak to an expert. If you ask me what to do the surgery or don't do the surgery, I'd say speak to the surgeon. If you ask me, should we demonstrate, will it be harmful or will it be helpful, speak to the expert. In the great book by Joseph Telushkin called The Rebbe, he has several chapters on the Rebbe's approach, which we already referenced. Again, we don't have the time, but you can read it from page 10 and on, and you will see the stories of how the Rebbe advocated for quiet diplomacy. It's very interesting that though the Rebbe argued for quiet diplomacy, and in very public Fabrengen spoke out negatively and blamed those involved in the demonstrations for being harmful, he still cooperated with them. And I love, there's a great quote, one of the great quotes here. Here it is, on page 13, the left-hand column. On one occasion, when the Rebbe realized he was not going to succeed in getting a demonstration canceled, he told Rabbi Israel Meller, Olav HaShalom, president of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations and an active proponent of protest demonstrations, the Rebbe told him, quote, if you're going ahead with demonstration, at least make sure it gets on the front page of the New York Times. Right? So the Rebbe cooperated. It's part of the beauty of the philosophy of the Rebbe. He had his position. He thought it was wrong. If it was going on anyway, he still cooperated, including with having cooperated with Rabbi Riskin. The Rebbe called Rabbi Riskin into his office and sent him on a trip to the Soviet Union. And here you have the whole story of the Rebbe involved in quiet diplomacy. Again, in this hagiography called the Rebbe used the language quiet diplomacy. If you go to page 16, the left-hand column, you'll see a story where at a dinner later, after the fall of the Iron Curtain, when President Reagan, was reflecting on the success, what phrase did he use? Mrs. Reagan now said President Reagan needed to use quiet diplomacy with Gorbachev. Quiet diplomacy were the very words the Rebbe had used earlier to describe what was necessary. So in this very biased book, it credits the Rebbe's philosophy, not of the demonstrations, but of the Rebbe's efforts for quiet diplomacy with the success of the fall of the Iron Curtain. The last source I give you, and I allow you to take it home and read on your own, pages 19 to 24, are only a small part of a greater excellent article. Rabbi Dr. Adam Furziger, who I actually just saw in Israel. Adam Furziger was my madrich when I went on March of the Living as a kid. Today, that's not the most impressive thing on his resume, shockingly. But today, I think he's a professor at Bar-Ilan. He's written many interesting scholarly books. And he has an article about American Orthodoxy and the Soviet Jewry activism. It's an excellent article. This is only part of it, where he traces this debate between the Rebbe and Rabbi Teitz on the one hand and the others on the other hand. And he has the following fascinating thesis. First of all, he quotes that Rav Moshe sent a message of support that was read publicly by Rabbi Tendler at a 1968 rally. So even though Rav Moshe had written that thing against the rallies, Rabbi Tendler believed that Rav Moshe believed in them because he gave him a message to be recited at a rally in 1968. On page 21, Furziger writes, there appear to be both geographical and generational factors at work in the debate between public activism and behind-the-scenes diplomacy that simmered within American Orthodoxy. The Rebbe and Rabbi Teitz, as well as almost all the major Orthodox rabbinical authorities, were Eastern European-born. He concludes that all those who opposed the demonstrations had lived under oppressive regimes, and that their opinion was influenced by their experience. Whereas these young students, who had only grown up in the freedom of America, had no fear, had the confidence, with no backlash, to take to the streets. That's his thesis, and he goes on and tries to prove it. Part of his proof of it, by the way, this is interesting. Mom, you'll find this interesting. My mother grew up in Elizabeth, and my grandparents were incredibly close with Rabbi Teitz, whose picture hangs on the wall of my office. Rabbi Teitz with my grandparents. On August 25th, 1963, Rabbi Teitz spoke at a civil rights rally that took place at the New York Polo Grounds and encouraged Jews to join in the March on Washington that was scheduled for the following Wednesday. Unlike some of his traditionalist Orthodox colleagues, Rabbi Teitz was sufficiently comfortable in America to take a public stand on controversial matters. When it came to his brethren in the Soviet Union, however, the Latvian native and former Lithuanian yeshiva pupil could not imagine Jews acting with such brashness. So Rabbi Teitz had it in him to demonstrate. When it came to civil rights, he participated and encouraged others. But when it came to this, it was different. Again, if you want to see more of his evidence for this thesis, I refer you to these last pages. What is the takeaway? Soviet Jewry movement clearly had an indelible impression and forged the identity of a generation of Jews. It had an impact. It made a difference. It was an enormous success. It gave us self-confidence that today continues to animate and inspire the lobbying efforts Jews have in all of our interests, from tuition to, of course, the U.S.-Israel relationship and much more. But I'll conclude with what I referenced at the beginning. For those who participated, look at those names I mentioned who were among the student leaders, and look what it did for their very Jewish identity. They emerge the most prominent names of Jewish leadership. Our young people today, not only young people, what are we fighting for? What cause are we willing to inconvenience ourselves and fight for today? What do we give up our Sunday? What do we travel? What do we donate our money? What is the cause that we're willing to fight for? We see the impact of a willingness to fight. What are we teaching our children and grandchildren is worth fighting for today? Because what we fight for, we hold dear. What we fight for influences and forges our very identity. And as a method of inreach, in an effort to inspire the next generations of Jews, it's worth our reflecting, what are we worth fighting for? What's worth fighting for today? Thank you very much.